But we promised Andow we'd take care of you. He has enough to worry about, taking over the business and all. I hope you understand. Nika pursed her lips. If I wanted to, I could rend that smile from your lips with a touch. I could split your face to scar so ugly that you'd never be able to show yourself in high society again. I could, but I won't. So there's no reason to guard me.
I believe you,
Mimi began in a tone to suggest otherwise. But it's nothing personal. We just like to err on the side of caution, and I think this is for the best. Nothing personal. And yet Nika had heard words like those from so many clients before, murmured under their breaths as they put away their jewelry boxes and pulled up their gloves. For some reason, this instance especially tired her, being trusted enough to be bought and hired to heal a family friend, but not enough to be respected. Still, she held her tongue, because she had considered swiping a geode or two. Miffed, she returned to her book. She read through the day. Mimi and Trin took breaks to grab food, but Nika was too enamored by the literature. The anatomy of the human body she knew well, but these texts filled in the gaps of her semantic knowledge, and she found herself putting names to structures she'd known only by touch and influence. They were fairly modern books, too, some from this year. Some terminology had changed since her grandmother had taught her. Nika finished perusing all the images and chapter headings of one book, prepared to move on to the next, when she faltered. At the top of the stack was a familiar cover, one with a human skull drawn in excruciating detail, simply titled, On the Human Body. She'd seen this book before. Her grandmother had purloined an earlier edition of the same book from a college library. She'd sat Nika in her lap with the book open before them, fishing a chunk of charcoal from the hearth to annotate. Atop the drawn diagrams of humans, their limbs spread wide in the anatomical position, she would chalk directional pathways through the body, marking out lines of influence.
See, Nika, humans don't heal others the way we do, she'd explained. That's why they have to draw everything out in detail, because that's the only way they can recognize it. But we...
She smudged the charcoal with her fingers, darkening some parts with pigment and leaving others without, until she'd highlighted all the main pathways through the body.
We don't need every detail. We just need to know how everything connects, how it all works together.
Nika had protested and squirmed, appalled that her grandmother had gone through such lengths to steal a book, only to destroy it.
You covered up all the most important stuff, she'd whined,
to which her grandmother had only laughed.
Did I, Kun?
You know, back on Yarong, not all Heartsoods learned from books. Your Jensoi, your great-grandmother, taught me with other people. But now that we live in Thumas, we have to learn from a book. I am trying to make do.
Nika remembered her grandmother's face, then touched by a gentle sadness, one that drew back the corners of her mouth and dimmed the light in her eyes. Recollections of Yarong always brought on that look, and some of that same unspeakable grief had rubbed off on Nika. But hers was for a different reason. Not heartbreak for a culture forgotten, but the fear that, living in Thumas, she might never know that life at all. That if she didn't learn it exactly as her grandmother did, then she could not pass it down as her grandmother could. That with each band of bone added to her family's ring, the gift of heart-soothing would only grow weaker and weaker, until one day she'd lose it completely. That had been the fear of a younger Nika. Now she had come to accept that she would never get the chance to pass down her heart-soothing at all. Nika put the Kongmi's copy of the book aside, knowing that she lacked the emotional fortitude to read it in Mimi and Trin's audience. There was nothing new to be learned from it anyhow. She was just about to move on to the next book when a servant arrived, announcing dinner. Dinner. At its mention, she realized the late hour, and her stomach growled with hunger. Nika wondered if they would give her a meal Or if, like the butchers, they'd only bring her leftovers. Mimi and Trin both stood to depart, and her eyebrows arched with interest. Would they finally leave her alone? But they turned, Mimi tapping her arm.
Aren't you coming?
To dinner?
Yes. After all, you are a guest of this manor now, remember?
It took a moment for the words to soak in. Nika stood, hands clammy from the gloves, and set the books aside. Oh, okay. They turned to leave the library, their backs exposed to her. By instinct, she found the little sliver of exposed skin on their necks, right beneath Mimi's pinned curls and Trin's tapered shave. For a moment, she froze, questioning this reality of dining with the heirs of the Kongmi estate. She had anticipated eating their meals, but sitting at their table? That felt a world apart. Then Mimi and Trin disappeared around the corner, and her indecision was dashed as she started after them, afraid she'd lose her chance at dinner. Her bewilderment soon sobered into hunger-driven excitement as they reached the second-floor dining room, with a view overlooking the garden. It felt private, not much glamour nor presentation, with simple chairs and a circular table. But the glass chandeliers and musical automatons reminded her she was still in the company of one of the richest families in Thumis. Andal was already seated. If it was possible, he looked even more tired than before, but kept a straight posture as they joined him. Mimi and Trin took seats on either side of him, but Nika hesitated, until at last a servant pulled her a chair at Mimi's side. She sat. There were a couple other seats at the table, unoccupied and without table settings. No one spoke as they waited for the food to arrive. Nika couldn't remember the last time she'd had a meal around a table, with place settings and a family. The last time her family had been complete had been 10 years ago, when she was 8, and her memories of dinner glowed with warmth and raucous laughter.
"Did you find anything?" Andal asked, clearing his throat and breaking her thoughts. The formality of his tone reminded her that they weren't her family, and this manor wasn't her home, and this dinner was only a meal, calories for her soothing. If she wasn't able to heal Hendon, they'd discard her without a second thought.
"I'll need to understand more of the neuroanatomy," she said, matching the decorum of his tone.
"Oh, I see."
Andal left it at that. He glanced at Trin, and then at Mimi, and their exchanged looks held unspoken words and secret meanings. Nika tried deciphering them, but only gleaned that they wanted to talk about something, something they couldn't discuss with her at the table. A waitress and her automaton companion, a laden tray on wheels, emerged from the servery with platters of food. The table let out a collective sigh, all of them grateful for the distraction of food. The waitress unloaded the automaton, setting the plates on the center turntable to be eaten family style, more variety in one course than Nika had seen in her entire life. Sweet fried fish, tapioca dumplings, rice paper rolls. Mimi gestured to the food.
"Please, eat."
But Nika had already discarded etiquette in her rush to fill her plate. It was more food than she needed, but she piled it on by instinct and a little bit of greed, taking a bite of every dish and ignoring how Trin wrinkled his nose at her. She stuffed her mouth after a mumbled thanks, the flavor bursting across her tongue. If she knew how to enhance her own taste buds, she would have, but the food was plenty savory by itself. So she just ate, and so did they, and the silence was dispelled by the sound of her slurping and chewing. She felt the nutrients flood her system, stalking her abdomen and even her blood, the buzz of energy awaiting expenditure. But the meal couldn't last forever, and as the servants cleared empty dishes and dirtied plates, the silence precipitated again. Nika licked the lingering flavor from her teeth, watching as the others exchanged their wide-eyed looks, at once ignoring her and treading lightly around her. Mimi cleared her throat, wiping her mouth with a napkin.
"I suppose we should address the upcoming funeral,"
she said, voice growing heavy. She drew a slow sip from her cup before continuing.
It's scheduled over 3 days. The rites, the wake, and then the procession. Nika, since I told the staff that you knew my father, you'll have to attend the wake and procession for the sake of appearances.
Though if it's too much to ask, we can make other arrangements, Andao was quick to add, and she could read his thoughts. He figured she'd make a scene. His next words came as a caution. There will be many important people in attendance.
No worries. I'll behave, she said, leaning back in her chair. Death was a sacred thing. Perhaps the humans didn't believe in afterlives and ghosts, but the Yarongi's superstition of her upbringing was hard to shake, and she wouldn't mess with a funeral for her life.
What year was it that father traveled abroad?
We could say he tutored her while he was a professor in college, Mimi thought aloud, but Andao shook his head.
Yarong was already under Daltony occupation when he was teaching, and Nika would have been too young, he said, picking at the last of his food. That'd be a complicated timeline to justify. I'd prefer we keep it simple.
My parents and grandmother were from Yarong, but not me, Nika spoke up, and their attention turned to her. She'd never even been to the island, and doubted she ever would. Ever since Daltony had started its occupation of Yarong, the tiny island had acted as a naval base for that war-mongering country, and her parents and others were lucky to get out when they did. Although Theumis remained neutral in the war against Daltony, and still did today, even as Daltony fought with the city's neighbors, it had tentatively opened its arms to Yarongi's refugees. Sometimes, Nika wondered if Theumis regretted that decision now.
So maybe father met you here. Before he went into the automaton business, he dabbled in medicine. We could say you're one of his students, Mimi suggested.
I've never had any formal medical education.
So? You definitely know more than the students there. I'm sure you can improvise something, Mimi said, and Nika's chest bloomed with a strangely pleasant vindication. No one had ever recognized the depth of her knowledge before. Just say you spent a couple years at Xialong College of Medicine. Father was a lecturer there, and they let almost anyone in.
But just in case they see through your education, you can say you've since dropped out, Andao added. And there it went. Precious validation. Although, he did have a point. She'd been improvising alternative medicine for the past 6 years, but she'd be among learned meritocrats at the funeral.
What about your family? Trin brought up.
His look held expectation, and she realized he wasn't asking for the fictionalized background. He was asking her, genuinely.
Gone, she said. Nika figured that was something the siblings might sympathize with, having just lost their father. But in their uncomfortable frowns, their crinkled brows, she found only pity. She continued,
but I'll tell the guests something boring. Maybe my parents are bankers, or officials for the commission.
Bankers, then, Trin said. The guests will know all the officials and delegates. If your parents worked for the commission, they'd want to know a name.
Nika shouldn't have been surprised, and yet she was amazed anew at how vastly different the Kongmi's lives were from her own. She could barely name all 5 commissioners, even though the commission was the elected head of Theumis's technocracy. Now the looming funeral felt like a test of how well she'd honed her ability to lie. This time, she wasn't selling a sham cure or fraudulent tonic. She was selling herself.
They'll ask about occupation, too, Andao added.
She waved a flippant hand. I'll make something up.
It's important that, don't worry, I won't mention blood carving.
Nika, Andao stressed, voice so laden with urgency that she quieted.
This is crucial. Please, we can't have anyone discovering what you are.
Her first instinct was scorn, but his expression wasn't ashamed. None of theirs were. And she realized this wasn't just about their reputation or the legality of her acquisition. There were those glances between them again, and behind the furtiveness, she caught a poignant apprehension. It reminded her that her bidders in the butcher's row had been elites like these. Perhaps the Kongmis weren't planning on dismembering her, but Nika wondered if the funeral attendees would be so generous if they discovered what she was.
Okay, she said, voice sobering. I won't stir trouble. Promise.
Andao's shoulders fell at that, though tension still corded his body.
Thank you, he said, the words sounding obligatory. It's for the best. Our safety depends on it. And maybe...
He shared a look with Trin and Mimi.
And maybe yours, too.
Nika spent her first night atop a silken comforter, staring at the ceiling. She traded the dress for an equally exquisite nightgown, and now she relished in how soft it was on clean skin, how smooth the bed felt against bare feet. Over dinner, they'd ironed out the details of her life, turning her as human as they could, her truncated surname, her polished family history, her impressive education. She was Swan Ko Nika, daughter of bankers and old mentee of the late Kong Mi Vun Guan, and who may or may not have flunked out of Jia Lan College of Medicine. Now Swan Ko Nika slept on beds like these every day and ate dessert with every meal. Swan Ko Nika could trace her family back beyond her grandparents, as though her heritage hadn't been abandoned on the island, stifled by war and colonialism. And when people touched Swan Ko Nika, they didn't fear death. So she'd been touched and hugged and kissed, skin against skin. And maybe Swan Ko Nika could live just a little bit longer. Nika still didn't grasp the root of Hendon's injury, but she was close. It was some blockage in the neuroanatomy, if only she could understand it. And then, one step further, she'd have to repair it, where she never could before. That was a problem for another day, though. Nika rolled over in bed, staring out her windows into the gardens that rolled into the sprawl of Theumis's cityscape beyond. If her grandmother's beliefs were true, and the ghosts of her family were hovering over her now, would they think she looked happy? Would they think she looked at home? Before coming here, she lived in a forgettable attic apartment hidden away in some corner of the dog burrow that reeked of fish and prawn. But it wasn't really home. That implied attachment. Nika never got so far as to have a future, and her past had gone up in smoke and ash. This was the first time she was expected to be somewhere tomorrow, and the next day, and the day after that. A sigh tapered through her lips, equal parts exhaustion and comfort. Another day.
7. By the time she woke up, it was nearing noon. She hadn't meant to oversleep, but in the dog burrow, she'd always relied on the rabble outside her window to stir her, the clamor of dock workers who woke with the dawn. With this estate in the dragon burrow, its acres of land every which way, the mornings were eerily silent. Except, there was a commotion coming from just outside her door, the creak of hardwood and a low collection of voices. Nika roused, and when she heard the rumble of an unfamiliar voice, she remembered to change into something presentable, one of Mimi's long-sleeved dresses. The gloves were an afterthought, grabbed on the way out the door. The voices emanated from Hendon's room, and when Nika drew closer, she heard low conversation between Mimi, Andao, and a third voice. Not Trin, but someone else. The door was ajar, and when she put her ear to it, she caught a bite of somberness.
I'm afraid there's been little change, and there aren't many medications I can offer. We just have to wait and hope. But Hendon has always been strong.
Beneath his voice, she could also hear something whirring, clicking, scribbling. Then Andao said,
Will he keep his memory when he wakes? It's hard to say at this point, said the unknown voice.
A sigh from Andao.
This doesn't feel right, worrying about his memory when his life is on the line. But if he doesn't remember that night, then
eavesdropping, are we?
Trin reprimanded, his voice blotting out the rest of Andao's sentence as he appeared behind Nika. She startled, then straightened her dress in a bid for dignity.
Don't make it a habit,
but I'll introduce you to Dr. Santo, Trin said. Just don't mention your occupation.
She wasn't planning on it, but now his contempt made her want to. And why not?
Because he's a doctor, and you're, well...
He didn't finish his sentence, though the answer was obvious. Nonetheless, she followed him into the room, finding Mimi and Andow sitting beside Hendon's bed, with an older gentleman pulled up to the bedside, right where she had been a day earlier. He was a thin man, with a clean swatch of whitening hair across his forehead and a round face framed by trimmed facial hair. Reading spectacles sat at the bridge of his nose, and they nearly fell off as he looked at her. This was the doctor then. Yet he wore humble clothing, just a dress shirt tucked into his pants.
Oh, hello, Nika, Mimi said,
and all conversation ceased as she entered. When Nika rounded the panel divider, she found a new medical device, this one the size of a game board, with a mechanical apparatus affixed to the top and a drawer holding a coil of paper. A needle produced a series of scribbles atop the paper, and Nika realized that the machine wired back to Hendon, who wore a strange headpiece.
I don't think we've been properly introduced, Dr. Santo said, drawing her attention away from Hendon and the machine.
He wore linen examination gloves rather than silk ones, which he extended toward her in greeting. Advancing a step, she took his hand, and he gave her a firm, fatherly shake.
Uncle Sean, this is Swanko Nika. She's staying with us for the funeral,
Andow said for her, as though he didn't trust her to remember her own false identity. His words came out scripted. Nika helped him along. Just here to pay respects. Mr. Kongmi was an old teacher of mine. Dr. Santo's eyes glimmered with welcome.
I'm Santo Kishon, but you can call me Dr. Santo. I was Mr. Kongmi's close friend, he said.
He turned a solemn gaze toward the man on the bed.
And Hendon's. But he's not yet lost. And, we must hope, neither are his memories.
Why is that? She asked. Dr. Santo gave her a curious look.
Because we wouldn't want to lose the Hendon we know and love, of course, Andow interrupted.
Nika narrowed her eyes, scouring for more. The siblings exchanged glances with the same nervous energy they'd had during dinner, but she didn't pry. Not yet.
What's this machine? Nika asked instead, sizing up the medical apparatus, which continued to scribble out peaks and troughs like the sketch of a long mountain range.
An EEG, Dr. Santo responded, an answer that meant nothing to her.
Yet, she felt a strange competition with it, with this doctor, because Hendon was her patient, after all. The siblings had told her the doctors had seen no hope for him, but Dr. Santo didn't seem like what she imagined a doctor to be. No loose-sleeved robe with embroidered pockets, just a man who looked like he belonged around a game board at the park with a group of other seniors.
What does it do?
She asked. Trin gave her a testy look, as though to dissuade her from talking, but she pretended not to see him. Dr. Santo, on the other hand, seemed eager to share. He reached over to point at the coil of paper, which ran underneath the inked needle and came out inscribed with close scribbles.
It measures electrical activity in the brain, see?
While that made intuitive sense, she had no idea how he translated the waves to brain activity. When she was in the brain, soothing Hendon and others, she could feel the electricity, the way it raised the hairs on her arm and bit at her skin. It was interesting to see, then, what a Thielman had invented to replicate that feeling.
This machine tells you that Hendon's in a coma rather than asleep? She guessed, because she could tell the same from her heart soothing.
His eyes alighted with approval.
Yes, exactly. It's a very small but crucial difference. Most people don't see that.
Most people weren't heartsoothes, she wanted to say. Andow cleared his throat, stealing back Dr. Santo's attention.
Can the EEG tell you the cause of the injury?
Nika listened in, knowing the problem was half the trouble of heart-soothing. But Dr. Santo shook his head, solemn.
Not without further research. This machine is still prototypical.
Nika examined the scribbles, trying to make sense of them. There were patterns there, certainly. Some rolling like the tides of the ocean, others fine and close, like spiked mountains. Not as visceral as heart-soothing was, but she knew the language of Thuman medicine placed a machine between the healer and the patient.
"It's okay, Uncle Sean," Mimi said, her tone cautiously optimistic. "It was worth a shot. At least you're still trying."
With a touch of shame, Nika no longer felt slighted that the Kongmis would employ both her and a doctor. Let them throw every ounce of chem they had at this problem. And Dr. Santo had something over her, a personal connection with Hendon. Her grandmother had always told her that the connection with a patient was the most powerful concept in heart-soothing. But her mother's death had taught Nika an equally memorable lesson, that sometimes it wasn't enough.
"Dr. Santo," called a voice, drawing their attention to the door. "You have a meeting at the 13th hour you can't miss."
When she turned, she found someone new. From where she stood behind the panel divider, it was hard to discern his features, but she caught a glimpse of his stern eyes, his unabashedly bare hands, and found she knew exactly who he was. That was the boy she'd run into in the horse burrow, the one who dropped all his papers. And most importantly, he was someone who might know she didn't belong here. Nika shrank back behind the divider. He hadn't seen her yet, as Dr. Santo disassembled and packed up his EEG, removing the headpiece from Hendon's scalp and stilling the needle.
"Don't give up hope," he reassured the Kongmis before moving to leave. "This isn't the end."
As Dr. Santo exited the room, the man lingered just a moment longer at the door, and Nika worried that he'd seen her. She only released her breath when he turned to leave, the last of his tailored outfit trailing out of view.
"Who is that man?" she asked Mimi and Andow.
"Mr. Venn? He works with Uncle Sean," Mimi replied.
"Do they know why I'm here?"
"No," Mimi admitted. "If Uncle Sean learned I made a Butcher's Row transaction, he'd never let me leave the house again. Best to keep that to ourselves."
Nika wasn't sure about the value of discretion if the boy from the horse burrow might recognize her anyway, but that was for the Kongmis to handle. It wasn't her who'd made an illegal purchase. She had other problems.
"If Dr. Santo wakes Hendon first, do I still get paid?"
"We'll make sure to duly compensate you for your time," Andow answered noncommittally.
Nika shifted her jaw and thought. It wasn't a race, and yet she felt a strange urge to beat Dr. Santo to the answer, to heal Hendon with her hands, where Dr. Santo needed his gloves and his machines. Now, which would it take to heal a man in an unwakeable coma? The human medicine or Yarongi's heart-soothing? And would she even make it that far if the mysterious boy from the horse burrow recognized her first? The funeral rites began the next day with a family-only ceremony. Nika and Trin watched from the gallery as the Kongmi siblings departed for the funeral home by carriage, dressed in solemn white. The manor fell to mourning too, with the automatons rested in respect and most of the servants retiring early for the day. With little else to do, Nika took herself back to the library to finish the stack of books she'd started on. Trin followed her, ever loyal to the siblings, and settled across from her as she read. She gave him furtive looks out of the corner of her eye, gaze occasionally flicking to his pistol. But she didn't think he would use it. Not now, at least. Nika thumbed through an anatomy reference book until her finger snagged on diagrams of the brain, cut in various orientations. The images here were drawn, rather than photographed, and the artist had colored the different parts accordingly. They almost looked like dried slices of pomelo. Nika whispered the names of the structures to herself to commit them to memory. The cortex, she knew. That was the part that lit up in activity when she soothed, an electrical storm of light and color. Sometimes, steeping herself in another's cortex brought on nausea. Then the cerebellum, drawn as a fern-like burgeon of growth. That was a solid chunk of tissue, something she could ground herself in when she synapsed. The brainstem next. She wrote that up from the spinal cord. It was how she'd learned to move her influence toward the brain. It felt like a rush of speed, faster than lightning. Now, she recalled the sensation of influencing Hendon, of that blockage, the resistance while jumping from brainstem to cortex. There was only one structure in these diagrams she didn't quite recognize from her explorations in the brain. The artist had depicted it as a pink, pinched structure, sitting above the brainstem. But there was no label for what it was, other than deep brain. She checked the print year of the textbook on its spine. 1010, a few years outdated. Nika snapped the book shut, drawing Trin's attention. He blinked the haze from his eyes and straightened in his seat, eyebrows raised.
"Did you find the answer?" he asked.
He made it sound easy, as if these science textbooks could translate so easily to heart-soothing, as if these words were written for people like her.
"No," she said curtly.
Nika caught the sleepiness in his expression, and when he stretched, her eyes drifted down to the pistol that revealed itself beneath his jacket. "How long have you worked for the siblings?"
"Since I graduated college."
His response was terse, but his voice held nostalgia. She tried to gauge his age, older than her by some years. "So, what is that, just a couple of years?" she estimated. "You've become quite close to this family in such little time." When she realized she'd let curiosity slip into her voice, she drew a new book into her lap to feign apathy.
"I've known them for much longer than that," he said, but didn't elaborate.
"But you knew they were one of the richest families in Thumis." His angular eyes grew especially critical, and he folded his arms.
"Are you trying to suggest that I only work for them for the money?"
Took the words right out of my mouth.
"The Kongmis are family to me."
"And yet, you weren't invited to the rites, a ceremony meant for the family." At that, his expression sharpened with annoyance.
"Why do you do that?"
"Do what?"
"Try to get under my skin? See doubt and conflict?"
She shrugged, avoiding the heat of his gaze by cracking the spine of a new book. "Just seeing what it'll take for you to use that pistol, I suppose."
"It's infuriating, and it's certainly not making you any friends."
"I'm not in the market for any," she snapped, then smoothed the anger out of her voice. She wanted to call him presumptuous, thinking he could read her so easily, but the words failed her, and she remembered she didn't need to justify herself to a stranger like him. She never had before.
"Even blood carvers must get lonely," Trin continued.
"And what would you know of blood carvers?"
"That you're just human, aren't you? That's what their father believed."
The annoyance simmered down into quiet regard as she looked Trin over a second time. Maybe he wasn't the brute she'd first imagined, but she wasn't going to take life advice from a hired hand. Without deigning to answer, Nika turned back to the book, searching for the section on neuroanatomy to distract herself. This book was published just this year, and when she found the sagittal drawing, she discovered they'd given that deep brain space a name. Thalamus. She tried the word on her tongue. It sounded a tad fictional, where the other structures, cortex, brainstem, sounded more intuitive. But maybe it was the answer. If anything, at least a start. She narrowed her eyes with renewed interest. "If you're going to linger, you might as well make yourself useful," she said, holding the book open before him and tapping the anatomical drawing. "You see this word? Thalamus? Find me papers and books with any mention of it, and keep it recent, this year or the last. I want to know what it does and what it's made of." With a begrudging grunt, he lurched to his feet, giving her a beleaguered look.
"A please would be appreciated."
"Aren't you used to being ordered around?"
"Mimi and Andow don't order me around," he reproached. "They ask kindly, and I oblige."
"How long have you been without a guardian again?" "Since I was 12. The corner of his lip quirked with a knowing smile.
"Yes, that sounds about right."
"What are you trying to say by that?" she grumbled, but he only shrugged with infuriating evasiveness. When he reached the shelves, he turned, arms crossed, and waited, It took her a moment to understand that he actually expected her to beg, and from the bottom of her diaphragm, she drew out a withered, loathful, "Please."
"Thank you."
He plastered on a smile and got to work on the shelves. Now that she had some idea of what she was looking for, she could pick up her reading pace, sorting books by year and skimming through them for that structure. With Trin's help, as much as it begrudged her to admit it, things went faster. She told herself she'd take her time in this library, but this was an exhilarating feeling, being so close to the answer. Now she raced to find it. He brought her text after text, and a new stack collected at her feet. Despite it all, she'd reached another dead end. All these anatomy texts had images and labels, but none would tell her what the thalamus actually was. None would tell her how to fix it. Maybe nobody knew. The mystery of it was murderous. But she kept reading anyway, breaking only to eat or relieve herself. The sun set incrementally, the room darkening every time she looked up from the pages until the library swam in golden light. A break in her attention came that evening when a servant poked her head into the library and announced, "The masters are back." Trin drew himself up. His attention left her, and Nika followed him out of the library, through the halls, toward the central foyer. They reached the mezzanine just as the Kongmis returned, still garbed in white. Nika lingered on the upper floor as Trin descended the stairs to meet them. Even from her vantage point, she could see the redness of their eyes, the solemnity of their expressions. Mimi met her gaze, eyes full with tears, but she turned away before Nika could say anything. Trin was at Andau's side, hand on his back, as the three of them fled to their own corner of the manor. Nika trailed behind like a misplaced ghost. Her feet moved of their own volition, creeping down the stairs and following the siblings at a distance to their room. They escaped to a private parlor, leaving Nika to linger outside the door. Her heart soothing could not quell this depth of sadness in anyone, or else she would have done it for herself long ago. Besides, it wasn't her comfort those three longed for. It was Hendon's, or their father's, or one another's. Blood carvers like Nika formed only one kind of connection, and that was at the junction of skin on skin. She turned to leave when a hiccuping sob paused her. Mimi's crying then turned to wails, the angered pain of a young girl betrayed, and the sound took her back in time, to an apartment in the dog burrow, to the moment her mother's paralysis had finally seized her lungs, leaving Nika truly, irrevocably, alone. She'd wished for anyone in that moment, her grandmother or her father, someone who knew her grief more intimately than she did. Someone who could tell her it would be okay and know it to be true. But her father had been lost at sea, and her grandmother had passed in the house fire that took her childhood home. And Nika had never felt more like the last blood carver, not even able to save her mother. Nika understood Mimi's pain now, maybe even better than Trin or Andau could. For a moment, she wondered if she should open the door, be the person she'd wished she'd had when her mother died. But it was not her place. As she was about to exit, a shadow traced the entrance of the foyer. Startled, Nika slipped into the cover of an armoire just as Dr. Santo entered the room, carrying a covered baking dish. He strode straight to the door and knocked without the hesitance that had frozen her.
"Mimi, Andau, it's Uncle Sean. I brought your favorite," he said.
Even from across the room, she could smell the waft of butter and pastry. Trin led him in, and after the door closed behind him, Nika drew out of hiding to listen to the muted conversation inside.
"I don't want to go, Uncle Sean," Mimi pouted through a full mouth.
Dr. Santo let out a sympathetic breath.
"I know it's hard, Mimi."
"I don't know if I can bear to see his body again."
This time, her words were accompanied by sniffles, the suggestion of tears.
"It's not for us, the ones who loved him privately. It's for his friends, co-workers, acquaintances, the ones who loved him in public.
They deserve a chance to say goodbye to him too, he said, adopting a tone that almost reminded Nika of her grandmother's, gentle, stern, and instructional all at once.
But how are we supposed to act?
Despite Dr. Santo's mollifying tone, Mimi's voice crescendoed.
Are we supposed to pretend this is just a funeral? That all the attendees loved him?
We have to put our best face forward, chin up. Remember, we're there to honor your father.
I don't see how when...
Mimi's voice cracked with tears, and Nika held her breath for her next words.
When father's murderer may well be a guest.
8. Murderer. Nika had never felt so much like an outsider, not even when she was bound in the back of her hearse, than now, because the Kongmis had forgotten to mention a tiny little detail about their agreement. They were asking her to heal the witness to a murder. Well, her stay with the Kongmis had been luxurious, but it was over. She'd leave now while Trin was occupied. Nika backed away from the door and bolted out of the room. This was the part of every client-sham doctor interaction where she ran away. This time, she'd take something as a souvenir, just to make this mess worthwhile. Her new clothes, or Mimi's makeup, and definitely a bauble from the library. Nika hurried up the stairs toward her room. There, she stuffed a bag with pillowcases, pants, paperweights. She was just leaving her room when her feet ground to a stop of their own volition, and Nika stood frozen in front of Hendon's door. For a moment, she couldn't move, and the door pulsed with its own heartbeat. In her mind, it shifted, no longer a stately door of the Kongmi Manor, but a time-worn entrance to a dog burrow apartment. Half immersed in memory, Nika pushed it open. Inside was her old apartment, pulled out of the past, and her mother asleep in bed. Dropping her bag of stolen items, Nika approached her and saw the extent of her illness, the thinness of her arms beneath the sheets, little more than bone, and the wrinkles smoothed out by sleep. One last time, Nika soothed her. She fell into the past, such a familiar anatomy, the calluses on her mother's palms and the deepness of her smile lines, and such a familiar problem. A ruin of tissue somewhere inside the brain, something Nika could sense, but couldn't soothe. Even now, this wound remained unyielding, like it was taunting her. A reminder that, even after 6 years on the streets, using heart soothing to heal scrapes and scam clients, she'd learned nothing. The memory shocked away when Nika withdrew her hand, finding herself not at her mother's bedside, but at Hendon's. The room was silent, the first time she'd been here without someone to guard her, and she let herself steep in Hendon's quiet company, in this waking memory before her.
Why did you have to go and injure yourself this way? She asked through her teeth.
Was the mother still teasing her, sending her a haunt of her mother's condition, the one thing Nika'd never been able to heal? Or was this a second chance? Nika touched the ring around her neck. She could have run then, put this mess of the Butcher's Row and Kongmis behind her. If their conspiracies were true, perhaps this job brought more trouble than it was worth, and a smarter Nika would have taken the chance to leave, to return to her forgettable corner of Thumis, and bid farewell to endless dinners and gilded libraries. But that also meant spurning the chance to use her heart soothing as it was meant to be used, to learn from an endless library of resources funded by Kongmi wealth, to heal the one injury she'd failed to heal before.
You bastard, Nika said to Hendon, knowing her heart wouldn't let her leave. I hope you're worth it.
Even as she cursed him out, Nika picked up the bag of goods and returned to her room. She restored the items to her closet, her desk, knowing that each was another anchor to her decision until it finally sank in. She was staying. Even if healing this man came with funerals and murderers, she had to at least try.
Nika, came a voice at the door,
and she turned to find Trin. He looked breathless, like he'd just rushed up the stairs.
I thought you'd run away.
She shrugged, trying to conceal how much she'd considered it. Why? Is there some reason I would run? Nika goaded him toward the truth. Didn't she deserve it, considering what they asked of her? But all he said was,
call it reasonable suspicion.
With a scowl, she waved him off. I'm not going anywhere. I've a funeral to prepare for, and a false identity to rehearse. Only then did she remember what Mimi had said.
When father's murderer may well be a guest.
Their suspects lay within the attendees of the wake. The Kongmis had mostly composed themselves by morning, though bags pulled at their eyes. Even Mimi looked haggard at breakfast, strands of hair breaking free of her coiled bun and makeup remaining from the night before. And Andow, well, he always looked sleep-deprived. Breakfast was a solemn affair, and afterward they all went to ready themselves for the wake. Even Nika. Thoughts of last night's revelation kept her quiet more so than the somber environment did. Now, Nika didn't complain about the gloves. One less thing for the family to reprimand her about. But the funeral outfit was constricting. A plain black dress with silk pants to match and a white headband wrapped around her forehead. They departed in a caravan before noon, with Nika in an auto carriage, a real one this time, alongside Trin while the siblings rode on ahead. On the road, she reminded herself that she was Swan Ko Nika now, and that she was meant to stay quiet and out of the way. At least that was something she was accustomed to, and she could feign grief just fine. When they pulled into a gated courtyard, Nika realized that they hadn't been keeping the body at a funeral home as most folks would. Rather, this seemed a private estate, much smaller than the manor, but matching it in elegance. A line of carriages circled the central driveway, dropping off guests at the doorstep, a swarm of black and white. When her carriage rounded the steps, the driver opened the door and they streamed out, finding the siblings in the crowd by their distinguished white garments. The estate's doors had been propped open, welcoming the guests to the wake. Inside, friends and relatives had begun to gather. Friends in black, relatives in white, with heads bowed and silent in mourning. She found the casket by following their gazes past the foyer and into the central living room, toward the back. Solemnity and silence hung in the air like a blanket, and Nika took the opportunity to find a lone corner in the back of the room to watch. It was the largest wake she'd ever seen, with an abundance of guests. And yet, few cried, so she didn't stand out, dry-eyed as she was. Nika took the opportunity to watch the people. Even though they all dressed simply for the occasion, everyone in the room exuded wealth with their careful makeup, glittering jewelry, and manicured hairstyles. It was a beautiful room full of beautiful people whose grieving didn't steal from their elegance. The constabulary was here too, and though they'd swapped their uniform for funerary colors, they still sported pistols and batons on their belts. It took her a moment to realize that they weren't here to protect the funerary services. They were here to protect the guests. Because if the Kongmis were to be believed, this funeral would be a congregation of the technocratic leaders of Thumas, commissioners, industrial executives, doctors, and engineers. Powerful people who no doubt each had ample motive for murder. More than suspicion or dread, she felt pity for the late Kongmi, that his funeral might invite enemies along with friends, one indiscernible from the other. As she traipsed toward the back of the parlor, Nika impressed herself with how well she managed to blend into this crowd. All it took was a shower and clothes that covered every inch of her exposed skin, her faded scars and blotchy arms and cracked nails. But still, she worried her etiquette might betray her origins, so she stood rooted in the corner, mimicking those around her and bowing her head to any who acknowledged her. The crowd eddied with shuffling gaits, guests taking their turns at the casket, but she only observed. As her eyes swept the crowd, they caught on the few people she recognized Andao and Trin, standing shoulder to shoulder, Mimi at her father's casket, head bowed, and Dr. Santo talking with a guest. Her eyes narrowed. No, not just any guest, but the boy from the horse district, Mr. Venn. It had taken her a moment to recognize him in the black funeral attire, but now she saw him in full. The styled wave of his hair, the darkness of his eyes, the tailored neatness of his suit. It was undeniably him. Before she could avert her eyes, he glanced in her direction, and their gazes caught. She tried to divert her attention, but he didn't look away, even as his conversation with Dr. Santo continued. Did he recognize her? Or did he just notice she looked misplaced? His gaze held hers with intrigue. Knowing she'd been found out, Nika decided to approach him. Gathering every ounce of boldness and social etiquette, she crossed the room and inserted herself into Mr. Venn and Dr. Santo's conversation. Dr. Santo? She greeted, keeping Venn in the corner of her vision. I'm glad to find a familiar face here.
Ah, right. You're from out of the city. Well, I hope you don't find yourself too isolated here. You'll learn names soon enough.
Dr. Santo gestured to the young man.
Let me introduce you to Venn Cochin.
Venn Cochin. It satisfied her to know his full name. She gave him a short bow. Their eyes locked. She measured his for recognition, finding only scrutiny.
Suan Konika.
Pleasure. The word came out disinterested. He cocked an eyebrow.
Waitstaff, I presume?
Cochin!
Dr. Santo reprimanded, just as indignation spiked in Nika's chest. So, he did remember her in rags and matted hair, even though she so clearly wore the funeral attire of an aristocrat now. Curiosity and shock she could have anticipated, but she hadn't expected contempt.
Guest, she ground out.
Briefly, she wondered if she'd misremembered their encounter in the horse burrow. Was he truly thwarting the butchers then? Or was he simply gathering his papers?
You don't exactly seem like you belong here, he said.
And both she and Dr. Santo opened their mouths to respond when Andao cleared his throat at the front of the room. As the siblings gathered behind the podium, everyone took their seats, and Nika was jostled into a chair in the back, rehearsing a dozen retorts in her head. Cochin, sitting near Dr. Santo at the front, didn't give her another glance. But Nika stared at the thin line of skin beneath his high collar and imagined what she might do with it. Her attention only drew away from him when the eulogies began. Family first, and then friends. She shouldn't have been surprised, but some were luminaries whose names and faces she recognized from newspapers. One was Mr. Nem, who dealt in the arms industry. Military technology like artillery, bombers, and ammunition. Nika figured that must have been a rough industry to be in, considering Thumas's staunch neutrality in the war, but he didn't seem too taxed about it as he took the stand.
The city has lost a flame, he began, his voice stentorian. Guan was taken from us before his time, and Thumas will always be left to wonder what could have been. He was an arrow knocked for greater things, philanthropy, grandfatherhood, maybe even the commission. Those of us here today will not be alone in mourning his loss. The entire city will be mourning with us. Such was the spread of his influence.
The commission? Though Nika never kept up with politics, she knew of the open chair for commissioner. It was big enough that even she had heard of the coming election, but she hadn't known Mr. Kongmi was running. Mr. Nem's eulogy ended with a slow collection of applause, and another took the stand behind him. Nika didn't recognize him at first, not until he introduced himself as Ngut Lien Buon from Ngut Inventions, the other big name in the automaton industry, although none could come close to the renown of Kongmi Industries.
This week, we mourn the loss of a great man, father, and friend, he said. Thumas has no kings, but if ever there was a man to have been our vanguard, his name was Kongmi Vun Guan. While many would have looked upon our industry's relationship as competition, I knew him only as a great role model and greater friend.
His voice took on a theatrical timbre, his eulogy just a soliloquy for this tired audience. Nika fidgeted with boredom as Mr. Ngook continued. As aristocrat after aristocrat stepped up to prove their posthumous love for the late Kongmi, Nika looked for the faces of her bidders. None of them seemed to be in attendance today. But she saw how this crowd, with its endless wealth, could find interest in the limits of what money could buy. Illicit drugs, exotic animals, odorless poisons, blood carvers. Her first funeral was her father's when Nika was 8. It was her first reckoning with death. Her grandmother had always told her that death was meant to be a celebrated thing, a reunion with the mother, and a return to the cycle. But that had always been hard to believe. Things died, she knew. Animals, people, even heart soothes. But nothing had felt so final as adding her father's portrait to the family shrine. It had been surrounded by other relics of their family history. Photographs her grandmother had salvaged from Yarong, a box of prayer items from her time in the priesthood, a ring made of onyx and bone. Because they had no body to remember him by, her dwindling family of 3 used his portrait for the wake and memorial. Today, the service was so full that everyone sat elbow to elbow, and yet she'd never been in a room that felt so empty. Around her, guests stood. Nika blinked back to reality, realizing the eulogies had ended. She was slow to move, following the languid crowd as they crawled to the parlor. Small groups split apart into quiet conversation over finger foods, and Nika grew wary of eye contact, lest she be drawn into one. Instead, she winded back toward the casket, daring to come close now that others had cleared. It was a simple coffin, all things considered, the dark mahogany polished to a shine and inlaid with lush velvet. The man inside did not fill up its space, but flower bouquets buffered the emptiness. Despite the traumatic cause of death, his body didn't look too worse for wear. The embalmer had given him an imitation of life, and Nika could imagine this man as he was, tall, features rounded, and expression sagacious. Of course, there were details that betrayed the illusion, like the pallor of his cheeks and the sunkenness of his eyes. Nika glanced between Kongmi Vunquan's body and his framed photograph just behind the coffin. Somehow, he looked younger in death than he did in the photograph, the lines of his face smoothed away by funeral preparation, and his complexion made spry by wax-like makeup. She could see his resemblance in his children. The elegant nose had gone to Mimi, the stern brow to Andao, and his diamond face to the both of them.
"I'm sorry about my aid," Dr. Santo interrupted, materializing behind her. "He's normally more respectful than that."
"It's no trouble. I get it a lot," she said. "So, Venko Qin was merely a physician's aide. Nonetheless, working under Dr. Santo must have been a prestigious and lucrative position if he'd been invited among this company."
"But you shouldn't, and especially not from someone who works under me."
He stepped up to stand beside her, the both of them drawn toward Mr. Kongmi's body in its coffin. For a moment, silence settled until Dr. Santo said,
"He almost looks as though he's sleeping, doesn't he?"
Nika thought of Hendon in his coma, of how similar those 2 bodies looked. And yet, if she could soothe them, their anatomies would be worlds apart. "You see death enough and it looks indistinguishable from slumber." She hadn't meant to sound so dark, but Dr. Santo nodded thoughtfully.
"Not your first funeral, is it?"
She resisted a laugh. "No." He looked sympathetic.
"I'm sorry to hear about your loss. It's not mine either."
"Because you're a doctor?" A rueful smile played at his lips.
"Yes, patient funerals, but also my son's. But it's..."
A muscle moved in his jaw.
"It's different. Losing someone slowly and losing someone all at once."
"What do you mean by that?" she asked, because his words hinted at feelings she'd parsed through too.
"My son was born with a hole in his heart. From the moment I found out how bad it was,
I knew he was dying. It was a race against time, trying to find any way to give him one more day. Surgeries, medications, therapies. But that's the thing about losing someone slowly. Every day, you have to watch them slip away from you, no matter how hard you hold on to them. Some days, it feels like things might improve, but then comes a fresh cycle of grief. At least with Guan. I lost him all at once.
I'm sorry about your son, Nika offered, the most genuine thing she'd said the entire funeral. In that moment, she saw a glimpse of herself in him, losing her mother the way he'd lost his son. Had he been chasing that failure ever since? Each patient a new mirror of his loss?
It's nothing you have to be sorry about, he said, and straightened his jacket with a huff of self-conscious laughter. Look at me. Just an old man babbling to anyone willing to lend me their ear.
You're in luck. I've no one else to talk to.
He gave her a curious look. Well, I can introduce you to some of the bigger names here if you'd like.
Like who?
He gestured for her to follow to a private corner of the room, a more fitting place for conversation than in front of a casket. Mr. Nem and Mr. Ngoot for two. They're both candidates for commissioner. Leading candidates, I suppose, now that Mr. Kongmi is...
His sentence tapered into a sigh. Right, Mr. Kongmi was running, Nika said, knowing that only from Nem's eulogy.
In the dog burrow, the tides of politics were not so important as the tides of the ocean, and most things got lost in the waves. The leaders of Thumis always claimed every person had a voice, but Nika learned Chem could buy 10, 20, 100 voices. Better to keep her head down and her voice to herself, especially when it never made any difference.
It's a tragedy, Dr. Santo continued. He aced his candidate placement exams. I don't know anyone who would have made a better commissioner.
A tragedy indeed, she echoed, finding Mr. Nem and Mr. Ngoot in the crowd. She recognized them both from the eulogies. Behind them, someone cleared their throat, and they both turned. It was Ven Cochin, who gave them a curt bow, hands clasped behind his back.
Dr. Santo, Ms. Mew is about to leave, in case you had hoped to catch her, he said, and Dr. Santo straightened.
Right.
He patted the pockets of his chest until he found something in the inner jacket. When he pulled it out, she realized it was a business card, which he held out to her between two gloved fingers.
For me? She asked, hesitant to grab it.
Nika made a quick scan for Andau or Mimi, someone who might think she were taking advantage of the funeral to network, but found them absent from the room.
I'm the research director at Thumis Medical Center, Dr. Santo clarified. If you find yourself wanting to stay in the city, give me a call. I'm sure we can find somewhere for you to fit in.
The business card lingered in the air between them, clean white against leather black. An invitation into this world. But as with her name, her education, her occupation, it would all be